Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. An important anniversary will be observed in St. Genevieve on New Year's Day. Catholics will participate in a special mass to celebrate the 200th anniversary of Bishop William de Burgh's arrival in St. Genevieve. Why is that event so important? That's just one of the questions we'll put to our guest, Monsignor Michael Witt. He is pastor at All Saints Parish in University City and professor of church history at Kenrick Lennon Seminary. He's also authored many books on early Catholic history in this region. Monsignor Witt, so nice to have you with us. Thank you.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Big event coming up on January
1st. It is. It's a big event. It's kind of exciting that we're going to actually celebrate it exactly 200 years to the date.
He arrived in St. Genevieve the day before, just in time for the Mass. Why is this such an important event historically?
Yeah, it is important because, first of all, he ends up coming to St. Louis rather than New Orleans. The see was actually in New Orleans, but he decided to come to St. Louis instead. It really is the introduction not only of just a bishop into this region, but all the other people that he brings with him. So he's going to be bringing the Vincentians, who are going to build a seminary in Perryville. That seminary, St. Mary's of the Barons, is going to provide priests for the entire American heartland. So there you also have the Religious of the Sacred Heart he'll be bringing to St. Louis also, St. Rose Philippine Duchenne, and with that the first girls' school west of the Mississippi, in fact west of the Alleghenies. You're also going to have along with that the Christian Brothers will be coming. They'll be very short-lived, but in 1818 they take over St. Genevieve Academy and run it for 1 year. We lose them again, and they'll come back to St. Louis in 1850. So you have the beginnings then of all of these religious orders that are coming in and setting up the institutions that are first. You know, the first university is going to be, of course, St. Louis Academy or St. Louis University. It's going to be founded by Du Bourg. So he his coming is very important, not just to Catholic history, but to the regional history itself.
How does it happen that he could say, I'm not going to New Orleans, I'm going to St. Louis instead?
It's a great story. He was threatened. He went to New Orleans to begin with, and that's where his see was. And then he went from New Orleans to Europe, first of all, to be consecrated as bishop by the Pope, and then afterwards to spend almost a year or more traveling throughout Europe, just trying to recruit, get people to come over to help him. In the middle of that, he received a letter from a supporter in New Orleans who said that if you come back, they intend to kill you.
Who's they?
They was a little junta in New Orleans. They were big supporters of a priest there who had preceded him. He had been there for some years. And this priest was one of those kind of fellows that would he was very indulgent. And, you know, that whole thing about New Orleans and laissez le bon temps rouler, they were all into that. And when Du Bourg comes, he begins saying, no, we Catholics don't do this. We cannot do this. And they, well, they didn't appreciate it one bit. So much so that he was not even able to go to his own cathedral.
Wow.
He was blocked from his own cathedral.
When he was in Europe recruiting, at that point did he know he was coming farther north than New Orleans?
At that point, he decided that the only thing he could do is go north. He wrote to the office that was in charge of missions, the Propaganda Fide, and explained what was going on. They gave him permission to transfer his see from New Orleans to St. Louis. And both, of course, are very small villages at that time, a couple thousand people.
Yeah, I wanted to talk more about what life was like here. But so he knew he was coming here, and he knew, I guess, that because they were small villages, if he wanted to really get things going, he had to bring people in with him.
Definitely. Yeah, definitely.
Right. Yeah. Well, what was like, aside from the fact that it was a small village, what was the influence of the Catholic Church at that time in this area?
In this area, actually, it had been around for quite a while. You know, the area was originally explored by by Joliet and Marquette, 1673. So there's a Catholic presence even that early. And Marquette and his work with the Illinois Indians in particular, and the Kaskaskia Indians too, many of them were Catholic. By the late 1700s, there was a group of Trappist monks who had fled from Switzerland when the French invaded, and they came to Kentucky. And while they were in Kentucky, some of the Native Americans in this area found out about that, sent a delegation down and asked if they would bring priests up, which they did. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, there was a Creole man who owned a lot of property in Illinois, and he gave them what is now today Cahokia Mounds. And mm-hmm. they put their monastery on the biggest mound, which is why it's called Monk's Mound. Now, most of the monks ended up going back to Kentucky, but one of them, Father Dunard, continued staying here. So there was some priestly presence even at the time that when Dubourg arrived here in St. Louis.
In his travels to St. Louis from Europe, I'm assuming that he would have had to, and to get to St. Genevieve first, that he probably would have had to come through New Orleans and upriver.
No, he didn't. Uh-huh. What he did was he landed in Baltimore, dawdled there a little bit too long, and the winter started coming on. That's when he came over to the Ohio River, came down the Ohio, and then from there up the Mississippi. And actually, the Mississippi by this time was pretty bad. It was winter in December. Mm. And so he lands actually in Apple Creek was the first spot. And then from there moved up to St. Genevieve, rested there, and then from there went on to St. Louis on the 5th of January.
So I guess that route was determined by that threat. He wasn't going to take any chances.
That's true, but also that was a part of what was known as the French Crescent. Mm-hmm. When the French were here in America, basically they had a crescent that went from the St. Lawrence Seaway down through the Great Lakes, and then from there the Illinois River to the Mississippi all the way down mm-hmm. to New Orleans, that whole area from Quebec to New Orleans. And then they cut that off by using the Ohio River instead. Mm-hmm. That ended up setting off the French and Indian War by moving too close to the American colonists. So that was the route. If you're going to come from the East Coast down, that was a good route to take.
With all the recruiting that he had been doing, did he travel with an entourage of some of these folks, or did they come over separately at different times?
Many of them came over actually before him. Mm-hmm. The Vincentians were actually here before he arrived. In fact, Father DeAndreas went from Perryville up to St. Louis, and I know he went to St. Genevieve. And then the pastor at St. Genevieve, Father Pratt, Henry Pratt, came up to St. Louis in order to prep the city for the arrival of their bishop.
I don't want to get too far ahead, but yeah. When did he finally wind up in St. Louis?
He ended up on January 5th of 1818.
Because just a couple of days after, resting in St. Genevieve. Right. What was St. Genevieve likely like in 1818, January 1st?
It was a little bit smaller than it is today, but not much. Not much changes in St. Genevieve. It had those colonial houses that were there. It was in many ways a premier spot. The French was still spoken. In fact, it was spoken here in St. Louis. I've got a great story about that. The agriculture in the area was important. There was some trapping that was being done. Good relations with the Native Americans, the Osage, and others in that area. So St. Genevieve was that, and then Cahokia were really important spots, because coming up the Mississippi River was arduous. Especially when you got to the confluence of the Mississippi and the Ohio River. Getting past that was just terrible. And so you really needed a couple of days' rest.
Well, imagine making that trip under the conditions that existed in those days, in weather like we're having today.
You have
5-10 degrees, whatever it is outside right now.
Yeah, that would be brutal.
It probably was not unlike today. Maybe a little warmer, maybe a little colder.
Yeah.
He and how did they travel? By horseback? Coach?
They came down by way of, well, they came down by way of a barge down the Ohio River.
So he was on water throughout until he got to St. Louis.
Until he got to Apple Creek. Uh-huh. And then from there, I don't know whether they used horse or walk, to tell you the truth. I don't know.
Well, it only took 4 days to get here.
But they had to go on the Illinois side, by the way.
Why?
Because there was no road in between St. Louis and St. Genevieve. So you had to go over the river and then come up what is now Route 3 and then cross over East St. Louis to St. Louis.
And how would they get across? So is there a ferry or some such?
Later on there would be ferries. Yeah. I assume that they used small boats at that point.
What kind of a guy was he?
Oh, that's interesting. He was enigmatic. He was brilliant. You know, he had one of the things he brought with him was his library. He had 8,000 books. Huh. I mean, you know, in 1818, that's a bunch of books for St. Louis.
Probably more than there was collectively in the entire region.
I think so, probably. Yeah. Uh-huh. So he was very bright. Had been for 1 year the president of Georgetown, what became Georgetown University. Had fled from the French Revolution, made his way here to actually to Baltimore and served there for a while. But at the same time, there was another streak about him that was just very strange. He would turn on people at a strange moment. One of those Trappists who had come, Father Denard, had done beautiful service here, had 15 years, something like that, basically up in where in Florissant and St. Ferdinand's, and then traveled all over saying Mass and for other people. All of a sudden, he just turned around and he said, "You can leave now."
Hmm.
And poor Father Denard finally ended up going back to a Trappist monastery in France. You know, so he was very strange in that way.
Did that characteristic, that personality trait, persist throughout his lifetime?
Yeah. In fact, in the letters that St. Rose Philippine de Chêne sent back to France, she mentioned some of the incidences like this. He would just come out to their place out in Florissant at the shrine there, and then just all of a sudden he'd say, "Well, okay, I want to open another school in northern Louisiana, and you know, you sisters, you know, three of your sisters go down there," and the sisters are going, "We can't do that." Uh-huh. And he goes, "Yes, you can. I told you you could."
Uh-huh. You know, and so they would have to do that and have to start absolutely from scratch.
Yeah, crazy.
And a crazy part of the world in the sense that it was really not very well populated or very sophisticated at that time.
Yeah.
I have to take a break now. We're talking to Monsignor Michael Witt. He's the pastor at All Saints Parish in University City. He's the author of several books. And we're talking about the 200th anniversary of the arrival in this neck of the woods of Bishop William DeBoer. And a big event is going to be taking place in St. Genevieve on January 1st. We'll tell you about that when we come back. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. And welcome back as we continue our conversation with Monsignor Michael Witt. We're talking about the arrival in St. Genevieve 200 years ago of Bishop William DeBoer. You had indicated you had a pretty good story to tell Monsignor Witt about him in St. Louis and French.
Yes. Everyone knows about Father de Smet. Mm-hmm. And he was a young man recruited by Father Nerinx. Nerinx had gone back over to Europe and had smuggled almost a dozen young men out to come to America. And his thought was that they would come to Kentucky and serve there as priests. Instead, almost to a man, they decided to become Jesuits. Mm-hmm. And so they went instead then to the Jesuit novitiate on the East Coast. And then at that point, DeBoer invited the Jesuits to come to St. Louis. And they did by transferring their entire novitiate to St. Louis. And so they made that same journey down the Ohio River and up the Mississippi. Father de Smet, or at this point just Peter de Smet, was fluent, of course, in French and Flemish because he was from that region in Belgium. And so he's been studying for 16 months. He's been studying English. He's not very good at languages, but he's starting to catch on to it. So the Jesuit scholastics arrive on a flatboat, and he immediately jumps off the boat, and he's going to try out his English. And he walks up to a levee worker, and he says to him, as best he could in his English, he goes, pardon me, could you tell me where the cathedral is? And the man looks at him and shrugged his shoulders and go, demain, je ne parle pas anglais. In the middle of the United States. And yeah. And he finds, all of a sudden, he finds that he's in a city that is at least bilingual, if not the first language is being French itself. So this is 1823. And so St. Louis still has a tremendous Creole background.
So the worker that he approached could not speak English.
They couldn't speak English.
Is what he told him.
Yeah.
What was the status of the cathedral at that time?
Oh, the cathedral was not the one that we have today. That's Rosati's Cathedral.
Yeah, sure.
The prior one was located actually just directly north of the one that's there today, north and a little bit to the east. And it was a red brick structure, but it was not very well built. In fact, it was collapsing just less than a decade after it was built.
And the other was built when? I should know this, but I don't off the top of my head.
Yeah, the other was built around 1818 when Dubourg first arrived. Mm-hmm. He did a bunch of things that same year. So the prior cathedral was actually a log cabin. And it's all located on this same piece of property. The interesting thing is that piece of property where the old cathedral is today never changed hands. It has always it's been in the hands of the Catholic Church from the day that Laclede arrived and gave that section. It was called the Place d'Église, the church place, and it's been in the hands of the Catholic Church. Ever since then, no other piece of property in St. Louis could say that.
You know, I wonder what one of his background would think coming here and seeing what was available here from brick buildings and log cabins as churches, if you will, having come from Europe and been privy to the most magnificent churches in the world at that time.
Oh, I know. Yeah, there's so many stories about people like that. Rose Philippine herself was from really a very wealthy family, and then she ends up here.
He recruited her as well?
He did.
He did, okay. Yeah.
And well, let's say she recruited him because
that's right. That's what you said earlier.
Yeah, he went to the Religious of the Sacred Heart asking for help. And as he opened the door, she knew exactly who he was. She was not the superior. She was an assistant. Mm-hmm. And she immediately ran over, knelt down, and held the door doorpost, and she cried out to Mother Barrett. She said, your permission. And she'd been wanting to come to America ever since she was a young woman. Mm-hmm. And so that's how, in a sense, she recruited him.
Yeah. What was their relationship like? Do we know? Because I asked that because both of them had a very specific interest in education.
Right. Yeah. It was a one of respect. They both respected each other quite a bit. Although Dubourg acted like a bishop in a lot of ways, sometimes asking her to do almost the impossible. When they arrived here in St. Louis, the religious, the three sisters, he sent them out to St. Charles. Hardly anybody out in St. Charles. Mm-hmm. He rented for them a drafty cabin, and they were supposed to set up a school like that. Eventually, after that just not going off very well, he then offered them his farm up in Florissant. And so they then transferred over there. But every once in a while, he was very generous. He would give them all kinds of things, statuary and all kinds of support. But at the same time, he was also very demanding. Mm-hmm. And Rose Philippine was a woman with a strong sense of independence. She had been through a lot in that French Revolution herself. Mm-hmm. And she was not somebody to be trifled with. always obedient, but at the same time, always pressing her case whenever she could.
All of those people in those days, to come to a place like this, as it was then, had to be tough people.
Oh, yeah.
I just lost my train of thought here with regard to what I wanted to ask. Oh, well, I was going to say that she kind of had the last laugh, I guess, in the sense that she was she is now Saint Rose Philippine.
Yes.
And he is not.
And he is not. No.
I'm interested in that personality of his. I just wonder what it was that might have triggered whatever quirkiness that he had here. What kind of power did a bishop have? And I use that in the religious terms in that day.
It would have been one of authority, but not of power. Mm-hmm. Everything that a bishop is able to accomplish, and certainly in that day, was grounded in the obedience of the people that he was serving, whether or not they would do it or not. And there were a lot of examples also of some people that just went rogue, priests that went rogue. Monks. There was one fellow from Pennsylvania came out here, and he operated as a priest independent of – this was before Dubourg arrived. And then all of a sudden after a year or so, he just disappears. Mm-hmm. And somebody had written to his superior, the abbot at the monastery, and the fellow he has no control over him.
So you're saying when they went rogue, what do you mean? They would establish their own sect or something of that nature?
No, they would claim to be still operating as Catholic but without any jurisdiction. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, it was a tough job that he had. Let's take it beyond 1818 and his contributions following that, once he was established here. We've already talked about education. What else can be attributed to his time here?
I think the single most important thing that happens after he gets these things established is that he is able to persuade Rosati to accept the episcopal honors to become a bishop, because Rosati is now the first bishop of St. Louis. Remember that Dubourg is bishop of Louisiana, which runs basically from Canada to New Orleans. Mm-hmm. But Rosati, with Rosati, you have the establishment of the Diocese of St. Louis and the service that Rosati gives to this community, not just the Catholic community, but in general, is just phenomenal. Mm-hmm. He's somebody that I think a lot of us don't appreciate enough, Bishop Joseph Rosati.
Yeah, the mass that was celebrated back in Saint Genevieve, it was of course in Latin.
Yes,
correct. Which is what's going to be happening on January 1st in Saint Genevieve. Tell us about that and the planning for that service.
Yeah, this is a pontifical high mass. It's quite extraordinary. My hat's off to Father Nemeth for thinking about this and making the arrangements for it. It's difficult to do. And in fact, one of the other jobs I've inherited just this past spring was the Archbishop made me the rector of the Oratory of Saints Gregory and Augustine, which is a traditional Latin Mass community.
Congratulations.
Thanks. I had to learn Latin as a result.
Oh, no.
Struggling.
Then I take it back.
Yeah.
that's not an easy thing to learn.
No, I served that Mass 50 years ago as a child, but I didn't pay attention, obviously. So, there'll be three priests. One will be acting as priest, another deacon, and then subdeacon. It's quite an extraordinary experience, and the people who come to it are going to have the experience that the people of St. Genevieve did 200 years ago to the date. It's quite extraordinary.
And that's going to be happening at 3:30 on January 1st at the St. Genevieve Catholic Church. And you're delivering the homily.
I am, yeah.
Huh? What are you going to say?
What we've been talking about.
A history lesson?
It's going to be a history lesson. I'll be talking about some of the important characters in the Archdiocese, but particularly those involved with St. Genevieve directly. And then the most important thing is the motivation, like we've been talking about. Mm-hmm. Why would you give up all the splendors of Europe to come to this backwater area, and you're doing it for one reason, and it's the glory of God, the greater mm-hmm. glory of God. And, of course, that's the motto of the Jesuits, but everybody else was doing that for that same purpose too.
Well, as we reach the end of our discussion, we have to point out that he came and did good work, but he didn't stay.
He didn't stay.
Yeah. What happened?
What happened was that when the Vatican decided to divide Louisiana into two dioceses, New Orleans and St. Louis, Dubourg was able to choose which one he wanted, and Rosati would get the other one. By now, he had reconciled with the people in New Orleans, and he liked the climate a lot better than St. Louis. So Dubourg chose to go down south. Then he started transferring. He still had, so he started transferring priests down into his part of the diocese. Uh-huh. And when Rosati called him on it, he got angry and he left the United States and went back to France.
Incredible story. I mean, it's wonderful history. Monsignor
yeah.
Michael Witt, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Congratulations on your role and all of this event that's happening. Once again, I'll remind folks the Mass to celebrate the 200th anniversary of the arrival of Bishop William DeBourg in St. Genevieve's on January 1st at 3:30 at the St. Genevieve Catholic Church. Sounds like a wonderful day.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Bye. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.